Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Carl Marlantis discusses his novel Deep River, which the Washington Post called an engrossing and commanding historical epic about one immigrant family's shifting fortunes. This conversation originally took place August 7th, 2019, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Tonight, we're here to talk about Deep River, the story of Finnish immigrants who flee persecution in Europe and land in a logging community in the Pacific Northwest. There, among their fellow newcomers, carving out a living from the wild, unsettled world, three siblings learn what it means to be American in a land still figuring out how to define itself. The Washington Post called Deep River a feat of lavish storytelling, and Booklist described it as unforgettable. Carl Marlantis, who brings us this story, is the author of the best-selling Vietnam War novel Matterhorn, and the nonfiction, What It Is Like to Go to War. Before his decorated service as a Marine, he was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University and graduated from Yale. So please help me welcome Carl Marlantis.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. And for those of you who are members of this museum, I had no idea, because I could remember going, gosh, how could they ever do a museum about, you know, writers? What's the difference between that and a library? And I'm like, my eyes have been opened. It's really very, very cool around here. I'd love to spend a couple of days here. I thought what we'd do tonight is I'd tell you a little bit about my background, I mean, how I got interested in this, and why I think I can write about it, and then what sort of motivated the particular novel. And then, yeah, I'll read a couple passages. I won't inflict more than that on you. I mean, I've sat through authors reading their own works, and you really are taking a chance. So I grew up in a logging town on the Oregon coast, Seaside, Oregon. And it's sort of a hard to sort of remember what it was like, you know, and part of what was motivating me is I wanted to try and capture what it was like. The time setting on the novel is, of course, a half a century before when I was a child. But I have all the stories from my grandparents' generation, my great-uncles, my aunts, great-aunts. And we were still logging old-growth forest in the 50s and 60s. In fact, the peak cut in Clatsop County was 1972, which surprises a lot of people. But what that was a result of is ever-increasing technology. I mean, these huge old-growth stands. And, I mean, people, it's just hard to imagine these old-growth forests. And I've seen them because when I was a child, I could be in them. The first ones that went down were the ones that you could drag to the water. Well, then when those were gone, then you had to figure out some way of getting the next ones to the water. Well, then railroad trains had to come along, and then logging roads and trucks, and then high-speed logging, then helicopter logging, as it got ever increasingly difficult. So in 1972 in my county, that was the last of the old growth. And it's not one of these sort of industry go like this and then a gradual decline. I mean, when it was gone, it was like that. I mean, the town has changed enormously. There's very little logging, very little fishing. But as a child, it was all logging and all fishing. And I grew up with my grandfather, Swedish-speaking grandfather, who was a gill netter on the Columbia River. So when I was in high school, I fished with him because he got his legs crushed in a logging accident. And one of the things that was really a part of my childhood was this is very dangerous work. And we've had advances in safety. I mean, OSHA, which all the people where I grew up used to hate OSHA because it would slow them down. It actually saved lives. It's one of those things that's like, you know, if you look at it, it's like, okay, come on, you guys. But five of my friends' fathers died while I was growing up just in the woods. It's a little tiny town. I mean, there were 60 kids in my high school class. It was, and you think, oh, that's just horrible. But to us, it was like, yeah, well, Perry's dad died in the woods. You know, we all go to the church and go to the funeral, and then that had happened a couple years later. And I mean, it was just sort of normal life. And it's hard to explain to somebody that was normal life. That was normal life. People went and died in the woods because it was just what you did. And it was dangerous work. And the other side of that work is the loggers that like I said, I didn't log, I fished. That was dangerous enough. They're really proud about how dangerous it is. I mean, they don't want to get themselves hurt, but facing that every day, it's It's an act of courage, and you have to take your hats off to them. And you think about the people that first came here, they're no bigger than me, and the trees were from that wall on average, you know, over to here in diameter, and often they were all the way over to here. And my uncle John Pavala said that it would take him 2 days sometimes to get a tree down and out, 2 days. 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day, 20 minutes off for lunch, 20 cents an hour. And it was really heroic. But the irony of it is no more old growth. So you have this incredible heroism with this irony of we just basically squandered it. My house in Cannon Beach, Oregon, which is just 5 miles from where I grew up, all the walls are made out of old growth Douglas fir clears. I mean, that means there's no knots in it, because in the day they would start maybe 10 feet from the ground, because you didn't want any wood that fluted out like that, and they would cut to the first limb, because after that it would be just a waste of time. And so enormous amounts of really, really good wood was just left in the woods. The walls are covered with this stuff that you'd make guitar tops out of today, because it was cheaper than sheetrock. I mean, it was cheaper than sheetrock. You can imagine. But nobody thought about it at all. And I remember, again, it was John, who was a high climber, saying that they had a discussion once in the bunkhouse. It was an argument whether they could actually cut out the trees in Clatsop County. That's in the very northwest corner of Oregon, just south of the Columbia River on the ocean side. They thought that they couldn't do it, that the trees would grow faster than they could cut. And then he said some German named Steele invented the chainsaw. And it's that technology thing. You know, we're always innovative. And suddenly, instead of just for 14 hours a day, it was like that. And, you know, instead of one tree in 2 days, it was like 10 trees, 12 trees in 1 day. Huge difference just with that one invention. But going back to these early loggers, one of the things that was really struck me when you talk about physical labor, we have no idea. A woman analyzed the inputs into a logging camp mess hall, and the number of loggers that ate there, and just added up how many, you know, dozen eggs and everything went in there every. She estimated that the loggers burned 16,000 calories a day. Now that's physical labor. I mean, that's Michael Phelps, all right, and everybody knows that he's a phenomenon. Well, these guys, that was just an ordinary day, 16,000 calories. And I'm going to read a passage, because my grandmother worked in one of those mess halls, and so I got some really good information about what it was like. But I got to go back to my own upbringing. My mother's first language was Finnish, and my father's first language was Greek. And my brother came up with the term cultural schizophrenia, which is kind of what we lived in. But, of course, my mother's mother spoke Finnish, but her father spoke Norwegian. His name was Leif Erikson. You can't get any more Norwegian than that. But then there was trouble in that marriage, and then my grandmother married Axel, who was a Swedish-speaking Finn. So I had Greek, Finnish, Swedish, Norwegian, and English rattling around the house all the time. And I'm sorry to say that I only know how to name the cookies in 5 languages, because that's the level of where I was really interested. In order to communicate with each other, we defaulted to English. And so my brother and I were just like, English, that's great, you know. And we called it old country language. You know, we don't want to talk old country language. And my grandparents in particular didn't want us to talk old country language. They wanted to be Americans, and they wanted us to be Americans. It's a very interesting thing. When do you drop the old culture? Do you drop the old culture? Can you be an American if you can retain the old culture? And this question faces immigrants today, faced immigrants at the turn of the last century. It's faced this country as long as it's been in existence. And I think it's something we still haven't quite figured out. Maybe we never will, because every new group of immigrants probably has a different problems. So I'm in this house with these different languages batting around. And my grandmother, was a character. She didn't like to speak English because she thought it was just a stupid language. I remember saying that. She says, Finnish is just so much better. It's much more descriptive. And so she didn't tend to do it. So whenever you communicate with grandma, she would do it in broken English because I couldn't speak Finnish. I could sort of, like I said, ask for the butter and pass the milk, but it was about my level. But she was an ardent communist. And a lot of the early Finnish immigrants were very radicalized. They were the radical socialists. They were the ones that started the co-op movements. And there's two reasons why that particular set of immigrants was like that. The first is that they were under the heel of the Russians. And Finland belonged to Russia up until the revolution of 1917. And so it wasn't like in most European countries where you had labor and you had capital and you had that kind of tension. In Finland, you had labor and capital and a foreign oppressor. And so they tended to get a lot more radicalized for that reason. And the other reason, which is very interesting, is that the Evangelical Lutheran Church, which was the state church in Finland, would not confirm you. In other words, you couldn't become a member of the church and take communion until you learned to read. And the church taught you how to read, which is very unusual because most European peasants, and these are peasants, but they were all literate. So when the Finns came over, they were literate, but they had a handicap. The Finnish language is so different than English. I mean, it's not even Indo-European. And there's a lot of theories about where it comes from. But the Swedes and the Norwegians, Germans, Irish, they all had immense advantage because their languages were really very close to English. And the Finns were very different. So on the one hand, they're also then thrown onto themselves more, their own language newspapers and stuff like that, because of this difficulty with the language. And my grandmother... I could remember, she lived in Astoria, and I literally, the Daily Worker was on the kitchen table, and I always thought it was the local Astoria paper until I was, maybe about 15 years older. Right? Oh, that's a communist newspaper, And one of my favorite stories about my grandmother, who was just, ardent communist. When I went off to Vietnam, I was a Marine, and I went to Vietnam, and just before I left, I thought I'd have this farewell from home, and I'm sorry you're going, I hope you come back. And my grandmother said, why are you going over there and fighting for Wall Street millionaires? Grandma, thanks a lot. And then I was beginning to wonder, maybe she was right. I can remember her slapping her hand on the top of the Daily Worker, and she used to use choice English phrases. I mean, English was really good for things, like swear words and stuff, and she would use those. And this one was, "That's the last straw," and I remember her saying that. And now I know what that was. That's when she quit taking the Daily Worker. It was when the Russians invaded Hungary, and it was really hard for these communists because they really were idealists. I mean, they really, really believed that the worker paradise would come. And my grandmother was one of them. And in Astoria, in the 30s, a whole group of Finns, I mean, maybe 100, sold everything and took their families, their children, and moved to Russia because it was going to be the future, the paradise that they had wanted. And it was horrible. I mean, they were sent to concentration camps, and they were... I mean, it was awful. Lost everything and disappeared. So, you think of the naivete, and yet how it was fitting in with this incredible struggle, which we still deal with. I mean, we still have income inequality that's rampant, and we still have immigration problems, like I said, this the problem of how do you integrate. I mean, all those things were going on. And my grandmother was also a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, which is the IWW, and it's not International Workers of the World. People usually get that wrong. And it was a radical union movement. Their idea, which makes pretty good sense economically, was instead of just striking by industry or even earlier by craft, which is what the American Federation of Labor wanted to do and did do, they thought the best way to do it was to have everybody strike at once, one big union, so that if there were unfair wages any place, the economy would shut down until the wages got
got right. And there were a lot of communists in the organization who thought that that was the beginning of the fading away. They bought Marx and Engels, and that would be the fading away of capitalism to the new society. Didn't work out that way. I mean, they didn't get it right. But that was what was driving them. And they got a reputation for very radical politics and violence. And it's unearned. I really wanted to look into that because my grandmother always said, we never blew anybody up. We never did that. It was always these anarchists, you know, gave us a bad name. And I think that it's pretty clear that first of all, they hauled in IWW leaders all the time and accused them of crimes, violent crimes, and never once was there a conviction. So even in spite of the fact that the, I don't know what you call it, the feelings of the country was against them, they still couldn't convict them. So my conclusion is that they didn't actually, weren't involved in the violence. But what they were involved in, and what I think got them in the hot water, and it's in the novel, is that when World War I came along, they saw this as their opportunity to strike in the lumber business, in the logging, because they were making no headway. And when the American government needed lots of spruce for airplanes, and so did the British government, that's why Boeing's in Seattle, because those early planes were made out of spruce. They thought that was their time to strike, which, again, tactically is correct, but strategically it was a very bad move because then they got the label of being unpatriotic and against the war effort and sabotaging the war effort. And the government passed a law called the Espionage Act of 1917, one clause of which says that if you are caught thinking about overthrowing the government, you can be thrown in jail. And they used that to crush the Union. They arrested 240 IWW leaders in one night, and that ended it. And it was this decision to strike during the time of the First World War. So on the one hand, nonviolent; on the other hand, made a serious strategic error. But the result was the government had to draft the loggers into the army in order to get the production because the woods were shut down. And they formed something called the Spruce Division, which very few people know about. And all these loggers were drafted into the army and paid as privates with an 8-hour day, which was heaven for the loggers. I mean, as privates in the army, they got clean sheets, they got food, it was amazing what change it was to go into the army as a private compared to what they were getting paid as loggers. And the Spruce Division was very important because it finally did something that's really hard to accomplish in our country, compromise. You had the owner saying, well, if we give in to the IWW, then we're losers because we give in. It's the beginning of the slippery slope. You know, pretty soon they'll be wanting to own our companies. You know? And the other side of the coin is these bastard capitalists over here, they're going to squeeze us till nothing. You know, and nobody got any place. I mean, it was just a deadlock because both sides were very strong. Government nationalized, basically, the industry, drafted all the loggers into the army. And when the war was over, it was like, well, the wage was, you know, at least army pay and 8-hour days and 5 days a week. And so the IWW was responsible for putting the goal in place. And the way that it worked out was this move to draft. But my grandmother wasn't, you know, she's not anything like my character Ino, who was a major force, organizing force. But my grandmother was involved. And one of my great stories that I love to tell, I came home from college, and some of you in the room might be of an age to remember Joan Baez singing this song, I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Joe Hill was this famous IWW organizer. He wasn't really an organizer as much as he was sort of a crowd rouser. And he was a great parodist, and he wrote these wonderful parodies, and Pie in the Sky When You Die and Solidarity Forever are all Joe Hill songs. Well, he was the 60s icon, and so I come back from college, and Grandma, did you know Joe Hill? She stops like that, and she just takes a step back. That son of a bitch. I'm going, Grandma, this is a 60s icon. I mean, Joan Baez thinks he's great. Yeah. What do you mean, that son of a bitch? She said, we would work really hard, to get guys to hold the card, the red card, about this big, and showed you were a member of the IWW. If you got caught with that card, they'd fire you. I mean, it was like, it's hard to imagine. I mean, we have made progress here. If you were a member of that union and they found out, you were gone. And then you were blacklisted, you couldn't get a job in the Northwest. So it was scary to be a member of the IWW. And people hid those cards. They put them in their shoes or they, you know, whatever. She said that we would work so hard to get that. And then we'd have this big rally. And when there was a big rally, cops would show up from everywhere, standing around, all these cops, everybody's getting scared. Joe Hill comes there, sings a bunch of songs, and he leaves. Red cards torn up, thrown away all over the ground, 2 years of organizing down the drain. And I thought, wow, that's a story. You know, that's my grandma's view. Now, you know, how true that is, I can't say, but it's a great story, and it's in the novel. I developed a character who's obviously Joe Hill, who was involved with my principal character. And that comes from that story. The other stories that I got were just a lot of logging stories about the old days. I mean, like I was talking about the chainsaws and cutting, but one of my great uncles said that his first strike was to get clean straw and get a guy off of work a half hour early to build the fires in the bunkhouses, because they wanted to dry their clothes when they came in. And they slept in like three or four bunks high on straw. But the owners wouldn't change the straw, so the straw got wet, and then there would be lice in it and bugs, and they had to go on strike to get them to get clean straw. Another thing that we just don't think about, how close to the edge people were back then and how hard it was to make any headway. Think, well, we're going to get, you know, the $15 an hour minimum wage. Well, there's nobody dying over this one right now. And there were people ready to go to war to get straw. We're making progress. I mean, you don't believe it, but if you look back 100 years, I mean, you have to look back a long ways. We are making progress. And so those stories, I wanted to capture them. And I also wanted to capture the feel of this little logging town I grew up in. I can remember being in grade school and the floor trembling like that when the log trucks would go by, because the log trucks would go by with one log. One. That's all they could carry. Today, the same size truck will go by with 35 logs, you know, this big around, instead of one that's, you know, well, above my head when it's laying down. And the floor would tremble. And Sid Smith, who was the cop in town, I know he had a deal, because these guys got paid by the load. They didn't get paid by the hour. So they didn't slow down when they went through town. I mean, it was like, here comes a log truck. You did not want to mess with a Mack truck with a you know, 40-ton log on the back of it. I mean, they just let him go right up to the mill, usually north where the Columbia River is, or into the log, where they would load them into the sawmills from water. They put them in water in big rafts. And I wanted to sort of get the sense of that and the sense of the country. I talk a lot about the river, and Deep River is a symbol, just as the Columbia River is, of the sort of the cycle of life, the salmon and all that stuff, which is very important to the novel. In particular, what started me thinking about this book was I had an interest in mythology, and people, you know, who know me and know this book say, oh, wow, did you learn about, you know, Scandinavian mythology from your relatives? Not a chance. They thought it was, I mean, my grandmother's word for reading was foolishness. You know, why are you spending your time doing that? We could be out in the yard, you know, weeding, you know, or you know, work. Work was really important. And one of the things that... If you had anybody mentioned, you know, if it was a stranger, the first thing out of my grandmother's or any of my relatives' mouths, well, she's a good worker. I mean, that was the criteria, good worker. That means you don't waste your time doing stuff like, you know, reading mythology. I got into it because there was a woman in the library, and I like to tell this story. Her name was Mrs. Whitty, and the library wasn't as big as this room. It was about half the size of this room with books along the shelf. And on the other side of the room was the fire truck for the town's volunteer fire department. And Mrs. Witte was the librarian. And I desperately wanted to get my library card. And my dad, who was a master psychologist, was like, "No, you're not old enough. It's too much responsibility for someone your age. You can't be responsible for a book." You know, I was like seven or something like that. And you know, I'd ask him again a couple months later, "Am I ready for a library card?" "No, I don't think you're ready yet. You're not old enough." "Well, my brother's got a library card." "Yeah, well, he's 2 years older than you are." You know, it's like, so finally, I'm probably about 8 years old, and he says, "Well, I've talked to Mrs. Witte, and she thinks you're ready, and I think you're ready." So we go down to this little tiny library, and it's blowing like mad. The northwest coast of Oregon it rains 120 inches a year. I mean, it rains. I mean, it makes big, giant trees. But it's dark outside, and I'm in this little library, and Mrs. Witte's behind her desk, and on her desk is a library card that's about this big, with scroll work on it, and my name is put on it and everything, and my dad is standing next to me, and he's got his hand on my shoulder like this, and I'm standing and everything. So and Mrs. Witte is explaining to me how I have to be really good about getting the books back and not hurting the books and everything. She hands me my card, and I'm really proud, and I have that card for a couple of months. And my brother and I shared the attic where we slept, and he's at one end of the attic, I'm at the other end of the attic, and he comes wandering down to my end, and he goes, "What's that?" "That's my library card." He goes, "That's weird." And he goes back to his side of the room. He comes back. He says, "Here's my library card." And, you know, that was, I don't know what the 8-year-old equivalent of I've been had was, but it was I might have been going back to my dad. What? You know, anyway, Mrs. Witte got me interested in mythology. There was something called the Bookmobile. Every 2 weeks, the Bookmobile would show up, and she would write off to Salem, which is where it came from, about books that she thought I'd like to read. And the one that I remember most was Celtic Twilight, which is by William Butler Yeats. And it's about pukas and banshees and, you know, fairies in the walls and of these cottages and stuff. And I mean, I was really taken by it. And so from there, I got into Irish mythology and then Norse mythology, Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung. It became a lifelong passion. And when I was at Oxford, I think this was the height of my nerddom. I talked my way into a seminar on Old Norse poetic diction. And not only is it like, I don't think there's a course any place except there on Old Norse poetic diction. And it was taught by Ursula Dronke, and she was the Sigmundsson Professor of Ancient Icelandic Antiquities. I mean, it's just, I loved it. And I was the only one that didn't speak three dead languages in the class, but somehow I managed to talk my way in, and I got interested in these sagas, Laxdala Saga, Njal Saga, Egil Saga. These are the old Icelandic sagas that were created probably in the 9th century, maybe 10th century, and they were written down probably in the 12th or 13th century. And no one knows what Old Norse sounds like, but they pronounce it the way you pronounce Icelandic today. And there were a couple people in the class from Iceland, and it was just, the rhythms and the poetry just stuck with me. Da, 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 da. And I thought, wonder what it'd be like instead of Norwegians going to Iceland if I took my Finnish relatives and brought them to North America and had a saga about that. So that was rattling around in my head. And I got into something called the Kalevala. And the Kalevala is sort of the national epic of Finland. It's like the Tain for the Irish, or Song of Roland for the French, the Odyssey, the Iliad for the Greeks. And it was a collection of songs. There's a guy named Elias Lönnrot, who was a Swedish-speaking Finn. He was a doctor. And back in this is like around 1835, he was sent by the Russian government to a very far district, a remote district. I mean, in those days, we're talking about days of travel because there's hardly any roads to get to these districts. And it was called the Kaleva district. And in Finnish, if you have "la" at the end of the name, it means you come from that place, Verkkala, Penttila. It's a common end on a Finnish name, coming from a place of the water or the place of the waves or whatever. And he began to recognize certain songs. The characters were the same. The story would be different, but there would be a character, old Wainamoinen, who was a mage, a sorcerer. And Ilmarinen, who was a magic blacksmith, and he could build something called, he built something called the Sampo, which was like this cornucopia, but it was a mill that ground out all that was good for the world. And some people think it's actually the mill of the North Circle, star circling the North Star. And he recognized that these characters kept reappearing, and so he started to write them down and write these songs down. And most people think that it was probably powerful shaman that got into the folklore and just was passed down by word of mouth for centuries, pre-Christian. So it was truly originally Finnish, and there was no... I mean, the Finns don't have they're grouped with the Scandinavians, but their mythology is not Scandinavian in the slightest. There's no Thor or Odin or Freya. I mean, it's river gods. It's more like Native American religions, wind spirits, that sort of thing. But they had these powerful shamanic figures that they related to, and it became a cause celebre because Russia was trying to stamp out Finnish. It was trying to Russify the language, the typical colonial thing, bring them into your system instead of leaving them in their system. And this became a rallying point for the Finnish language. And in fact, Sibelius, at the turn of the last century, wrote a lot of music based on the Kalevala. If you look at his music, you can actually see actual Kalevala songs that he's written. So I thought, well, that'd be kind of fun, kind of interesting, write a novel that was based on the Kalevala and have those characters come to America and with the immigrants. But I soon realized there's no structure to it. When I started to outline it was just like, this isn't working. I wanted it to work, but it didn't work because it's a collection of songs. It's just a collection of different stuff with these characters. So the novel ends up with characters who are infused with the characters from the Kalevala. I mean, I have Ilmari, who's the oldest brother. He is a blacksmith, and he's deeply into religion. I'm going to, but he meets a Native American shaman who she starts to move him forward more to a mystical sort of view of religion, and then you have Jukka Heinen, who's called Jukka in here, and he's a minstrel, and he's into wine, women, and song, and in a good way. I mean, he's not, when you say that, our puritanical culture goes, but, we call those people who are into wine, right? Foodies, right? I mean, that's what they're into. But so it's just a different way of being in the world, and we all choose a way. But Aino was into communism. She didn't believe in religion, didn't believe in God, but she thought that the communists were going to make heaven on earth, and that was where she threw her life. And that is the true believer. I mean, Eric Hoffer was influential in my understanding of that movement. The True Believer is a great, great book. It became a religion. It was their religion without a God, except that then people stepped in and sort of took the role. Lenin, Stalin. I mean, humans like to sort of throw their individuality out there somehow, I think. So each of the characters in here is sort of reflects a character from the Kalevala. You don't have to worry about it. You don't know anything about the Kalevala. I always remember, I love to tell this story because Deb Seeger, when Matterhorn is very, very involved with the Parseval myth. I mean, hawk, the word for hawk in Middle Welsh is Gawain, and hawk is the knight, Gawain, and Melis is Parseval, and that whole thing. And I was telling the director of publicity at Grove about that, and she literally put her hands on the table and says, "Don't say that." "Why not?" "People will think it's an intellectual book and they won't buy it." Sort of a comment on American arts today. She says, "Don't say anything about it for 2 years, okay?" So I said, "Okay, I won't say anything about it for 2 years." But anyway, I can't help myself. The Kalevala is in this novel as well. And I had all that rattling around in my head, and I finally sat down and wrote an outline, a 58-page outline, and started, and I sold it. And then I had a deadline, which I missed. But I was doing some other things, some documentaries and stuff. I had a good excuse, I thought. But so anyway, the second deadline was, you better not miss this. And so I work my tail off, and I write by hand because I have my. This is my theory: is that when you compose on a word processor with Microsoft Word or something, you're always editing at the moment. I mean, it's like you're typing and oh no. And so it's a sort of a jerky process for me. If I write like this, it's just my body going, and after a while, you know, you just get into it. And I got into it. I got the first draft done, and I sent it in, 350,000 words. All right, I mean, if you give some idea, this is a big book. This is 220. So 350 is like, you know, that much more. And I sent it in to Morgan Entrekin, who I'm so lucky to have this guy. He was Kurt Vonnegut's editor. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut's on the walls here. Nothing from Morgan. 2 weeks goes by, and I'm going, I don't know what's happening. You know, a month went by, not a word from Morgan. 2 months went by. Finally, after 10 weeks, I got a 6-word email from Morgan. Great stuff, too much of it. So I was talking to him on the phone. I said, Morgan, I said, Anna Karenina is 351,000 words. It's not even as big as Anna Karenina. And there's a slight pause, and he says, Carl, I could never sell Anna Karenina today. Which is kind of sad, but I think he's right. And then what he didn't say to me, and I know he was thinking it, and you ain't Tolstoy. You know? So I cut 150,000 words. I mean, that's a whole novel in itself. And I threw whole characters out. And when you throw a character out, you have to throw their friends out, and you have to throw their spouses out and their children out. I mean, it's not trivial when you cut one character and you have to go through it. And it may still be lurking in there. I hope not. But someone may go like, well, who's this? You know, and it's like some dead character's kid or something, you know. I think I got them all. But so I did. I got 150,000 words, it came out to the size it was. 9 drafts. And I'm quite pleased with it. And I think it's been getting good reviews, as you heard. So that's sort of the story there. I thought I'd read a little bit, and then we could do some questions. I talk about Ilmarin and Vasutati, who is the Indian woman that is very important in the novel. She's sort of symbolic of a way of looking at religion and also of Native American culture. Ilmari is coming from his friend Ulico's farm. Ulico has just lost his wife, and one of the things that really was interesting talking to my grandparents' generation was how few women there were, especially, I mean, you'd have like 100 young men in a logging camp, and maybe 15 women, you know, 10 of whom were married and the other 5 who worked in the mess halls. And this gives you a little bit of idea of the longing that these guys felt. Ulico lost his wife to childbirth, which was so common. It's another thing that we forget about. I was amazed when I was researching it. If you asked a woman back in 1895 or 1900, how many children do you have? The answer would be something like 7, 4 living. I mean, that was the common answer. It was not like I have 4. It would be 7, 4 living, because they lost children. And at the same time, they had this religious faith that they were still there someplace. So that was really sort of stunning to me. Ilmari said goodbye to Ulico and set out for Ilmahenki, his farm. He passed the grave of Ulico's wife, buried next to a copse of dogwood. Ulico had asked him to read the burial service. The nearest pastor was in Astoria, and although he came often, he couldn't always do so. Just a half a mile from the little town of Tapiola, Ilmari passed a huge lightning-struck snag over 20 feet tall, whitened with age and scarred black from fire. Ilmari thought of God's wrath striking down from heaven. Why would God make a man prosperous enough to lend someone money, that's Ulico lent him money, and then take away his wife and baby? Why would he give and then take away Ilmari's own baby brother and 2 of his sisters? Why was there hell? He thought of burning, screaming with pain forever. How could God be so cruel? But he had sent Jesus to save him, so he wasn't cruel. He was just. He decided to stop thinking, because no one should question God. When he reached Ilmahenki, he saw a figure standing on the far bank of the river, barely observable against the wall of the forest that covered the high hills across Deep River to the north of Ilmahenki. It was Vasutati, the name given to the old Indian woman by the Finnish immigrants. It meant Auntie Basket. Every 2 or 3 weeks, Vasutati made the rounds of the farms and logging camps, selling her hand-woven baskets. She was the last of the Inisal Indians, a small tribe of Chinookan speakers who had lived on Deep River until they were decimated by European diseases. Ilmarie hesitated. Then he raised his hand in a tentative greeting. She stood there for a moment, and then she too slowly raised her hand. It seemed to him that the distance between them, the river itself, shrank to nothing, and he was captured by dark, solemn eyes. Then the woman turned into the forest and disappeared. He continued toward the house in the twilight, puzzling over the incident. In a surge of longing, he imagined a wife coming to the door to greet him. He sighed and went in. The house had no curtains at the window, no cupboards to hold Sunday dinner dishes, no furniture other than the utilitarian wood chairs. The knitted wool cap that his mother had made him 6 years earlier hung tattered on the wall. A good wife would have been embarrassed to let him out in public with such a rag on his head. He glanced at the dirt floor, devoid of the ubiquitous rag rugs that Finnish women seem to turn out in endless profusion, all the while catching up with their neighbors, gossiping, or just quietly weaving them before the bed by the embers of the evening cooking fire. If he had tossed a pebble in the center of that house, his fall would have echoed off the walls and in his heart for hours. I could read one more passage, or we could do you want another passage? Okay. This next passage I'm going to read is about women's work, Aino's work, though she's the principal character. And she has met Yuka at a dance, and through a series of things which I can't describe because it'll give away the plot, she ends up having to find work, and her brother Matty, her younger brother, who wants his own logging company someday, is working as a logger at Reader's Camp, and the guy she's cutting out her eye on, Yuka, also works there. So she manages to find a relative who knows the owner, John Reeder, Alma Wittala, who is one of her shirt-tail relatives, and Alma gets her a job. And this is the job that she did, and this is what it took to keep these guys in 16,000 calories a day. One of the things people don't understand is how important these women were to the logging camp's operation. All of these owners colluded. I mean, they just went and, you know, met each other at hotels someplace and just decided what the wages were going to be. And nobody would break that. I mean, it was just totally illegal, but that's the way it was done. So how could you compete for good loggers? You competed with food. If you had good food, these are young guys, 17 to 25 years old, and if they didn't like the food, they'd be gone because of the rate. The wage is the same everywhere. And again, my uncle, John is what they call him, Yuka's his name, said that you could always tell. He said if you went to a new logging camp and you wanted to know if you wanted to go to work there, he said the first thing you look for is the pigs. Why is that? If the pigs were fat, that meant they were eating a lot of scraps. And if they were eating a lot of scraps, that meant the loggers were leaving the food on the table. You wanted a camp with skinny pigs. And it was really important. It was how logging companies competed. The head of the mess hall and the woman, there'd be like the chief cook and then the woman who ran it, they were an important part of the whole operation, very important. So this is when Aino goes to work. Walking back to the dining hall, happy and relieved that she had been hired, Aino listened as Alma translated what Reeder had said. She'd get 50 cents a day. She'd live with the other girls in what was called in English the hen house and sleep on the floor on straw. She was on trial for 2 weeks. If she worked out, they'd get her a bed with sheets and blankets. 100 loggers ate every day, so she'd get every other Sunday off. The girls were good about trading shifts if something came up. After the dishes were cleared, she could sit down with the rest of the girls and eat as much as she wanted. There was a tub just behind the hen house with canvas walls for privacy. Before dances, the girls could bring hot water from the kitchen for a single shared bath in order of seniority. Work at Reeder's Camp turned out to be the hardest, most unforgiving work Aino had ever done, and she was used to hard work. She and the other three girls were up in the dark, even in summer, She mixed pancake batter, cut bacon, cracked eggs, made coffee, or frantically tried to keep up her end of an assembly line, making dozens and dozens of sandwiches, beef, ham, peanut butter, fried egg, leftover meatloaf, chicken, salmon. At 5:15 a.m., the steam whistle on the train woke them in. The fireman had been tending the fire in the boiler, getting the steam up since 4:30. At 5:30, the dining hall filled with men of all types, mostly young, mostly Scandinavian, but Irish, Slovaks, Scots, and Americans as well. Their wiry bodies had the stamina of distance runners, combined with the nimbleness of dancers and an astonishing capacity for food. One of the things that again, was really interesting is that the Hollywood image of a you know, lumberjack, which are, they're never called lumberjacks where I come from, is this big, burly sort of guy, you know. I mean, these guys are built like college wrestlers. I mean, it's in they're aerobic machines, and the agility. When you were cutting old-growth forest, you started up, it'll kill him later in the patch, but the trees fluted out like that, and no mill would take any of that lumber. It was considered crooked. So you had to start where it started growing straight, and so they would put in springboards that would be about maybe 6 or 8 inches wide, and maybe, you know, what's that, 3 feet long, and they would hammer them into a notch in the tree, climb up 10 feet. I mean, that's above here, all right? And then two of them, alternating every 2 seconds, left hand, right hand, would undercut that tree with axes. Then they'd go around the other side and saw it through, and down it would come day to do this. But the dancing part was the only parts of the tree that they took out was that straight part up to the first limb. So that was maybe 100 foot of log, all right? The trees were maybe 200, sometimes over 300 feet tall, but they wouldn't take the part with limbs because you had to cut all the limbs off, and it was just wasted time, and we don't need to anyway. We got perfectly good straight wood without knots, and you could sell that. And so a logging show in the old days, and still today it looks like a World War I battlefield, but the slash would build up this high. If you wanted to get from point A to point B, you had to be able to dance across, and they call it brush dancing even to this day, because if you fall down and slip into it and hit the ground, you're looking at to get back on top of this pile of brush that high. You don't want to do that. And so the way they would learn to do it is they would actually get on a limb and they'd feel it spring, and that spring them to the next one. And you watch these guys going across the top of that old growth slash. They're literally like ballet dancers. I mean, it's amazing the skill that they have. Anyway, that's where this, and their astonishing capacity for food. They focused on eating. Save for the occasional pass of butter, no one talked. One of my great uncles said that if someone talked when you were eating in the dining hall, people would just growl at him. You know, it's like, we're here for serious business, and that's eating. They devoured pancakes stacked 8 or 9 inches high, slathered with butter, syrup, and molasses, and put down bowls of oatmeal drowned in cream, consumed plates of eggs, bacon, and ham, and ate beans drowned in sweet tomato sauce for breakfast, and emptied 6 10-gallon coffee pots, all in about 20 minutes. She never had time to say more than a few words to Matty, her brother. After breakfast, the dining hall empty, Ina would watch the loggers clamber into the pre-dawn light, still not talking, the spikes on their boots chewing at the heavy plank floor. Within minutes, she would hear the first shrills of the whistle punks, the clattering of steam donkeys, the singing of steel cables running through blocks and winding into and off of the huge steam-driven drums, and the rending crash of fallen giants whose death she could feel through her feet. Those working more than a mile from the mess hall carried sandwiches of dark, heavy bread that she and the other flunkies had prepared scant hours earlier. The rest would walk in for lunch. She would stare at hundreds of dishes and coffee cups, greasy grills on huge wood stoves stretching more than 10 feet, straining to move huge pots of boiling water, pouring the water into sinks, tossing in soap whittled into flakes from one-pound cakes. She would scrub while the other girls, her seniors by hiring date, dried and restacked. Her hands grew red with the heat and harsh soap, but she had no time to worry about that. Prep work began immediately with wood to haul for the afternoon cooking of the evening meal, vegetables to chop for stew, onions to chop for pounds of meatloaf, massive amounts of dried beans to be boiled soft, salmon to butcher for stew or frying, hogs to gut, skin, hang to bleed, and then butcher, dough to knead into bread for pies, for cobbler, for dumplings, cream brought up on the rail tracks from places like Ulico's to churn into butter, buttermilk to be mixed with flour, and baking soda to make pancakes. Just before dark, the locust herd of 100 men once more descended on the dining hall, some shouting, some quiet, some sullen, all hungry. Men would shovel 6 or 7 pork chops onto their plates from brimming platters, or 3 12-ounce steaks when beef was served, to be followed by mashed potatoes into which they stirred honey or smashed tablespoonfuls of butter. In about 20 minutes, the huge coffee urns drained, milk pitchers emptied, meat platters left with only traces of grease, the dining hall would again be deserted. Under kerosene lamps, the girls washed and put away the hundreds of plates, cups, and bowls, and set the tables for breakfast. Then there would be the mixing of pancake batter and the carving of bacon slices and the walking into the huge metal milk cans full of cream and loading the empties back on the rail cars and finally staggering to the hen house. There the girls stripped to their underwear and collapsed into bed, Ino onto straw on the floor. Once a week, Ino got her bath after all the others. She distracted herself by doing the math, comparing the surface area of her body with the volume of water, assuring herself that despite the increasingly browner water, there was still a chance that she'd come out cleaner than she'd gone in. She yearned for a sauna. 2 weeks passed, and Alma told Ino she was on for good. The promised bed showed up on the back of an empty rail car. She felt a little guilty knowing that she got a bed because she was a girl, while the loggers had no beds and slept in 3-bunk stacks on planks covered with straw. She got over that the first night. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, writer and history professor Aaron Sachs discusses his new book, Up from the Depths, Herman Melville, Lewis Mumford, and Rediscovery in Dark Times. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.